How we found temporary shelter. Once, as a bedtime story, though he never truly slept, I told Bourne about my island of refuge, the place my parents brought me to when I was 6 or 7. There I had experienced a hard-won 2 years without upheaval, without war or refugee camps. On that island, I had begun to think I might live out my life. It had the same false sense of permanence as the balcony cliffs, only more so. We lived in an apartment in the harbor capital, but I remembered with such vividness not our home or the buildings in the city, but the botanical gardens and its decorative pond with a dead fountain in the center. Water lilies covered the surface with butter-yellow blossoms and round green lily pads with a raised edge that replicated the circular gray granite wall that surrounded the pond. The wall was just the right height that I could, on tiptoe, reach into the water and trail my hands there, tiny fish nibbling at my fingertips. In the silty water swam also carp, ponderous goldfish, and brown, mysterious eels with gills like explosions of lace. Fat, ugly frogs stood sentinel on the lily pads, and turtles the size of my thumb sunned themselves in that miniature world. Snails, whose gray shells were transparent so you could see the darkness of their coiled bodies, hid against the wall, and I had to be careful before leaning so I wouldn't crush them with my awkward, clumsy human body. Nothing that had been altered lived there. Biotech had been banned from the gardens, with the government set to classify artificial animals as akin to espionage. Malformed animals or rare ones could incite panic, and the newspapers ran articles about suspected biotech cornered and hacked to death by men with machetes. But my mother would say at dinner, my father rolling his eyes, that biotech was already out in the world more than people knew, that it was pretending, trying to blend in, to escape notice. After school, my friends and I would play at the gardens, overseen by one of the mothers or my father. We would climb the labyrinthine trees that overhung the pond, the ones with the intense strands of bright red blossoms that made me sneeze, the wind off the sea from across the road bringing a hint of salt and fresh coolness to our sweaty endeavors. Then we would be walked down the sea road to the harbor and home. Along the way, when I had money from chores, we would run into the corner store and get salted plums and rice candy. The old lady behind the counter never smiled, but would give me, free of charge, the little decorative umbrellas people used to put in drinks. Most days, if it hadn't yet gotten dark, my parents would go down to the beach with me after dinner. We would look for shells or wade in the shallows with our shoes off. I liked to watch the grumpy-looking sand-colored fish sway back and forth under the surf. Then it was back home to do schoolwork. And before bed, my father would read to me from a children's book or maybe even an adult book or poetry with pictures alongside it. No one made printed books on the island anymore, and electricity was on again, off again. But I didn't notice that, didn't think anything of it. I was going to live on the island forever. Each day would be just like the last, and each night also, with the ocean breeze surging like the sea was surging, with wind crackling gentle through the palms, and sometimes the little foot patter of rats or mice that entranced me but sent my father into frenzies of mousetrap building. In the mornings, a man who had grown up on the island and sold, among other items, boiled, filtered water in glass jars would keep an eye on me and the neighbor kids as we walked to school in our brown leather sandals and the badly made, itchy gray uniforms the school recycled year after year. We'd do our language arts, our math, our science, and then be released into recess. The school was across the road from the beach, and we drove wider than was prudent, blunder, explore the very limits of our territory. To uncover a huge palm crab or some wayward crayfish taking a walk from the nearby river. We rarely made it all the way to the sea without some adult calling us back. But I sometimes made it to the fence, to watch the mud flats where the river fed into the sea. I liked to observe the mud skippers, soft, slimy, puckish creatures with bulgy eyes and fins that doubled as a way to walk on land. I didn't even notice the marsh reek all that much. I liked the mud skippers so much, and the cautious fiddler crabs that would cover the mud when I was in the middle distance, but then disappear down their holes, leaving behind an empty ghost town when I was at the fence. The mud skippers didn't even blink, though, remained behind like gray statues, unmoving but for a delicate flutter around their amphibious gills. Gulp, 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 they'd go, before, at their own pace, plopping back into the water. Some of them acted like sentries, and others seemed to enjoy goofing off. It was hard to tell the difference, though. My mother asked a lot about the mud skippers, about whether any had strange eyes, or acted differently, or if I had ever seen anything else odd out there. No, I said, none of them did. No, I had not. She said she had heard a rumor about biotech seeking refuge on the mudflats. The biotech left a trail, she felt, and if you could track it to the source, that might be where safety lay. Which was when I guessed the truth. My parents didn't think that life would last. They thought the island was just a temporary shelter, that we would be moving on soon enough. It astonishes me now that I could have ever led such an opulent life, or had so much leisure time, or have looked at all that protein with a non-predatory eye. Any of that transported to the city I now lived in would have been ravaged and stripped down in half a day or less, the pond in the botanical gardens reduced to an empty pool of cloudy water, the mudflats just a barren plain. When I had finished telling Bourne about the island, he asked, "Is that from a story?" "No, Bourne. That was part of my childhood."
"So, it was a story?"
"No, it was real."
"Oh, yes, from when I was a kid," he said, as if he'd been filing away some of what I said as a separate book of fairy tales. I was the old bore who couldn't shut up about the good old days that had never existed.
"It was real, Bourne," I insisted.
"What's a dog?" he asked.
Sometimes I also told him, if I was up to it, about the dog I'd fed on the island and had to abandon.
"You know what a dog is." "A dog is a meal on four paws." "Bourne!" "You said that."
I said it as a joke, but there weren't any dogs left in the city, except on the fringes, distant and wary. No friendly dogs anywhere, because a friendly dog was a meal on four paws.
"Where's the island now?" Bourne asked,
as if islands could just float away, but mostly to change the subject. "I don't know."
"Is it still the same?"
"I don't know."
"I think it's not the same now."
"It could be the same." What did Bourne know? I remembered thinking. His own brief childhood he'd spent rooted in place as a kind of glorified houseplant. He had never been anywhere. But Bourne had pressed on, not realizing how much it bothered me.
"How do you know it happened?" he asked. "Is it written down anywhere?"
How did I know it had happened? Because of its absence now. Because I still felt the loss of it. But I didn't know how to convey that to Bourne then, because he had never lost anything. Not back then. He just kept accumulating, sampling, tasting. He kept gaining parts of the world, while I kept losing them. When I woke in Wick's safe place for the first time, or came to, Wick had propped me up against the stone wall next to him, facing the shallow water of a well. All was in shadow except the water, which emitted a light blue rippling glow. Above, the walls came in toward each other like a steeple, leaving just a small point of light at the apex. It smelled like moss and a clean sort of darkness. Two of my fingers welcomed me back with a vicious, lancing throb, along with a shoulder laced with shooting pains like an electric spider web. My legs were scraped and bloodied through my ripped pants, and my pelvis and left hip felt bruised. Not right, hurt against the stone floor. A weakness in my ankle could be walked off, but the state of my left ear was more serious. That I might always have to listen out of the other ear, the sound coming to my left side muddy, always have to be alert. I could still feel in my bones the reverberations of Mord's weight striking the earth, and I was much too aware of my body to even pretend to be a ghost again. Our shoes were dusty, dirty travesties, perched there defeated on the end of our legs, and I did not want to take mine off for fear of what I might find underneath. Wick's wispy hair had become disheveled to mad genius levels, and his face had gotten so dusty it looked like a mask, through which his eyes shone, wicked and intense. I didn't like the redness of Wick's face, his arms. I had thought him shaken but otherwise uninjured by our escape. But that redness made it seem as if he had been drinking or evoked certain algae when the water's been poisoned, a bloom that seeks contamination. It astonished me that despite this, he was relaxed, lighter, less worried, giving me an impish look. "Where are we?" I asked. He told me. Between us and the well, he had overturned an empty crate. A single black kidney bean trembled atop that rough surface, served up on a little plate.
"Can you guess what that is?" he asked me,
playing our old games, except usually I brought the salvage to him.
"A bean."
"Correct, a bean."
"But is it really a bean? It could be something better?"
"No, unfortunately, it is a bean of sorts."
"Where did you get the plate?"
"Never mind the plate."
"Are we going to eat the bean?"
Wick shook his head.
"No, even though that is technically our last food, from my pocket."
Down to a single bean. "A bean," I said.
"Impressive. Prodigal. The bean returns." "I just thought you should know how resourceful we were in our flight. Before I open the pack I found here and see what else we have."
He pulled a pack out from the shadows by his other side.
"Open the pack then," I said. I was hungry.
"Wait, though. Wait a minute."
Before us, on the saucer, the trembling bean hatched, and a tiny, moist insect emerged, glittering, spread diaphanous wings that seemed etched from obsidian. It looked like a dragonfly, but much more delicate. A damselfly that shook its wings once and took to the air, spiraled up above the well and disappeared into the darkness of the stone walls. Maybe it went out the hole atop the cistern, or maybe it decided to live in the cistern. Either way, we never saw our bean again.
What kind of biotech was that?
"No kind of biotech at all," Wick said. "I have no idea how it got in my pocket. I have no idea how it got there. No one made it. It was an egg. Something laid it in my pocket. Isn't that amazing?"
"You let it go."
Mock disapproval, still playing, but after born, it wasn't the same. Wick shrugged, fatalistic.
"If there's nothing to eat in the pack, Rachel, it doesn't matter anyway. Let a bit of the balcony cliffs live on here. Why not?" Our new shelter wasn't nearly as elaborate as our old shelter. The cistern looked from the outside like a sunken mound or slag heap of stones that must have fallen in and buried whoever had once lived inside. There was access through a movable stone where the mound had relaxed into the hillside, and a trapdoor beside the well that led to a tunnel that led to a disguised exit a quarter mile away. The circular well that occupied half of the flat stone floor enclosed brackish water, recessed a few inches below floor level, and perhaps once was contaminated. But biotech filters in the form of fat, luminous blue slugs clung to the sides of the well, patrolling back and forth under the water's surface. That and the electric burnt match smell to the water were the best indicators that no one else had ever found this place. Otherwise, they would have been taken by someone long ago. But it wasn't Wick's safe house. Instead, it was a safe house of the magicians that Wick had discovered several months ago, and in that sense, not safe at all. Besides, even broken and recessed, to the careful eye, it still formed a visible landmark on the horizon. I had only fragments in my head of what had happened after Mord's attack, glancing, stabbing memories of falling over, staggering up, of Wick dragging me, of sliding down into the ravine, of hiding there while Mord strode inexorable past the ravine and into the distance as if he'd never meant to harm us. And maybe he hadn't. Maybe he hadn't even noticed us. Perhaps Mord had just been there as a shock to the system, to smash his feet into the ground, bring all the vermin out of hiding. But the Mord proxies prowled near, too. And soon enough we were running through the dead broken trees, through the peculiar gray and black rubble that made it seem like the surface of some alien planet. I'd run until I was too weak, whatever shock had suppressed my pain and animated me gone. And I hopped and shuffled and Wick led me along, encouraged me forward, until I'd fallen unconscious not far from our temporary shelter. The pack held the usual, and no more than the usual. Survival rations, a knife, a canteen for water, a couple of shirts, an ancient first aid kit, a battered pair of binoculars, a gun without bullets, a compass, a few ancient protein bars I could tell already would be as hard as Mord's fangs. Wick laid it out in a row like an offering to the god of the cistern.
"Food for a week," Wick said. "Water forever. Well, at least for a lot longer than the food."
I had to lean over and turn to hear him. My poor other ear, torn and blistered, registering his speech as a faint, hollow clattering.
"Food for 2 weeks if we go down to one meal a day," I said.
"Dangerous. We're already weak."
"Can we carry this place around with us on our backs while we forage for food?"
"We can't stay here anyway." "I can't stay here," Wick said.
"What do you mean you can't?"
"My medicine. Those Nautilus pills. I need them or I'll die."
I just stared at him. It was the most naked thing he'd said to me, and until now his dependence had been an abstract thing, lodged only in my head. Mord's foot was falling again, about to crush me and Wick alongside me.
"The only place that I might find more is in the company building," Wick said. "You should head north, try to make it back to the city while I head south."
"You'll go south and I'll go north. When did you decide this for us?"
"Or you could stay here and wait it out until I return."
I snorted at that. "Stay here and wait for the proxies to come and surround this place and kill me? Or the magician to escape them and drop by? Or any old marauder who sniffs out the water?"
"Then north," Wick said.
"Stay here and die in the dark with the snails, or try for the north and die in the light? Leave you to your fate? I don't think so." But Wick wasn't done surprising me. He pulled an envelope out of his pants pocket. The envelope was the size of those that people used to send letters in, and thick enough to hold 5 or 6 sheets of paper. It was filthy with dried sweat and stains and ground-in dirt, had been folded and unfolded several times. He had not written it here at the cistern. He had written it well before we'd left the balcony cliffs and carried it around with him.
"I lied," Wick said. "I didn't just bring a bean out of the balcony cliffs. Here, take it."
But I didn't take it, looked at it, suspicious. Nothing had ever seemed more like a trap to me. "What is it?"
"A letter to you. From me."
"You forgot your medicine, but you took this?"
"The letter was in my pocket. The medicine was in my pack."
"I don't want to read it," I said.
"That's a lie,"
Wick said in a teasing tone. He even smiled.
"You do want to read it. Everything is in there. Everything I never told you because I couldn't. But you need to know. If I don't come back from the company, read it."
Wick was light, was making light because he was. All the weight of him was in that letter, and he was putting it on me. "There's only one problem with that, Wick. I'm coming with you. I'm not leaving you."
"Read the letter first, before you make that decision."
"No."
"Take the letter."
"No." He held out the letter. "No, what if you get sicker along the way? You'll never even reach the company building."
"Why are you making things difficult again?"
"I'm not being difficult, I'm being clear. After you just saved my life, after everything else, you thought you could make me leave you. But it's not that easy, Wick. I won't make it that easy." I snatched the letter from his hand, so I'll take your letter, but you can't stop me from going south with you. Wick was quiet then, gathering himself. A quiver of some strong emotion passed through him. But I didn't reach out to him or acknowledge, knew that if I did confirm the weakness at the heart of him, he would break into fragments. That maybe, too, the letter was the best of him, or the worst.
"If we go into the company," Wick said, "you may see things you don't want to see. It won't be what you expect."
I laughed, but not without affection.
"Oh, Wick, how would that be any different than now?"
I was tired of talking things out. I wanted to be on our way, gone south, out of this temporary shelter that in the end would just betray us anyway.
"If we travel together, don't read the letter unless I'm dead."
"That doesn't give me much reason to keep you alive." He snickered at that, and I nudged him in the ribs, and he dropped the subject. But I think the trust Wick was looking for wasn't about when I might read the letter, but something deeper. The truth was, I would never tell him if I read the letter. Wick would never know when I read the letter. He would only know whether I stayed beside him or abandoned him. In that temporary shelter, such simple things took on such significance. The way Wick held his head to the side, as if he lacked the strength, propped up against the wall to sit straight. The many old scars on his hands and arms that came from the bites of his insect biotech. The exposed skin of his neck that had a tautness and a kind of naked honesty that made me want to kiss him there. The way he looked at me direct from that point on, as if we were only a few steps from the end of the world. And he wanted to fix me in memory. I took off my clothes and used a rag dipped in the well water to clean myself. I washed out my clothes and let them dry on a rock jutting from the wall. Then I told Wick to take off his clothes, and I cleaned him as well, washed the grime from his face, gently caressed the bruises and scratches on his body, ran my hands over his chest, his back, his legs. When we were both clean, I laid my head on his lap there beside the shallow well, and looked up at the moss and cool stones above our heads, and for a long time I said nothing, did nothing, just listened as he talked about the balcony cliffs and how much he wished he had managed to hold on to his pack as we escaped through the air duct, how that would make our choices now so different, and how balanced against the fear and loss was the twinge of relief he felt, that without the balcony cliffs, there was so much less the magician could do to us, and how clever the moored proxies must have been to overcome our defenses. This last was Wick trying to be optimistic, trying to hold on to a bit of self-respect that absolved us in at least a small way.
"This place would have been easier to defend than the balcony cliffs," Wick said.
"And takes fewer bears to overrun," I pointed out. Just a twinge, wondering what would happen if Bourne went back to the balcony cliffs and discovered us gone, driven out.
"But there's nothing here worth overrunning."
"Except the water. Almost anyone might kill for that." "The balcony cliffs was too big for us anyway," I said.
"Yes, much too big and full of bears."
"Infested with bears."
"Clogged and clotted with bears. This place is bear-free."
"So far."
"So far,"
Wick agreed. The bears had been clever, smart, patient. They must have been listening up top, buried in the moss, quiet and hibernating, and aware of our movements to know where the traps lay, where our fortifications were strong and where weak. Even though this made little sense, even though we had been taken by blind fury and overwhelming speed and force of will, by a disrespect for casualties, and might never untangle just how thoroughly we had failed, and if we had been sold out by the magician, one of Wick's clients or someone else. Yet there was more to it than that. It was hard for me not to relive the moment of impact, the initial smashing impact of Mord creating an earthquake with no warning, and then the way the air had been sucked away, while at the same time pushing out again to buffet me, the way the sky had spun and gone away, and there was only Mord and the certain knowledge I'd be crushed to death. But Wick was somewhere else, had been circling different memories of Mord, laying the groundwork, thinking the words that might get him to other words he didn't quite know how to let out of his mouth, until they just came out in a rush. Wick had known Mord at the company better than he'd let on. You could say they'd been friends.
"He liked bird watching, and we ate lunches together, and he read so many books. He was curious about so many things."
And because of this, I gleaned from Wick's confession, Mord had done many different tasks for the company, even leading a team that studied the chaos in the city, the dysfunction they'd created, and how to overcome it, how to rebuild.
"But that was a joke. The company was already failing and losing perspective. The people in charge, cut off from headquarters, began to get strange ideas."
There came through then, in Wick's need to speak, to get this out of his system, a cascade of grotesque images, of strange ideas more monstrous than Mord, some of which I had glimpsed in pictures back in his apartment. Digging gap-jawed leviathans that ate the soil and vomited it back out, transformed but also cleansed of whatever had lived there previous. Flying creatures with many wings that blotted out of the sun and patrolled the skies and killed anyone who opposed the company. Among other ideas that seemed deranged and terrifying and more like someone's idea of how to torture the city. But none of it had gotten past the planning stages, except Mord.
"When the fish project failed," Wick said, "they abandoned the city rebuild as well. They put Mord in an experimental division as a kind of punishment. They blamed him for the fish project, even though it wasn't his fault, while the magician suffered not at all.
None of us could have withstood what he was subjected to then, Rachel, what he was selected for.
Was that true? Or was Mord always susceptible? I didn't think Wick had the perspective to know.
He could still speak and understand as they modified him and kept modifying him until it drove him mad.
The only outlet, the only relief, to keep a record, which Wick had smuggled out in a broken telescope through another employee after Wick left the company, along with the plans that had helped Wick become someone who made biotech, or at least modified it. There was more, but no matter how Wick tried to articulate it, some things can only be understood when experienced, and I had not experienced what Wick had experienced inside the company. Today, Mord had tried to kill us by crushing us under his tread. Today he was several stories tall and a monster. Wick was grappling with this, with the shock as much as I was. The wrenching dislocation of trying to make two separate worlds match up, the one that was normal and the one that was grotesque, the old and the new. The struggle to make the mundane and the impossible coexist, just as it seemed impossible I had ever trailed my fingers through the water of a pond to let the little fish nibble, or watched mud skippers through a schoolyard fence, or eaten at a fancy restaurant. He could still speak and be understood. The truth was, I didn't want Mord to be more like us. I wanted him to be less like us, to be able to say when he murdered, when he pillaged, that he was a psychotic beast, a creature without the possibility of redemption, with no humanity in him. I wanted something to be the same in the old world as in the new. So I listened in silence and I nodded and made noises like I understood. Yet my attention was elsewhere. The letter burned. It was like a grenade there in my pocket, and only I could determine when it would go off. Was Wick telling me this, allying himself with Mord, to prepare me for something in the letter? Or was he telling me this to lessen the impact of the letter? Or was this one last attempt to dissuade me from coming with him? We did not discuss the letter again, or the plan to go south. That was already set, and Wick knew better than to bring it up again. That night, evidence came to us from near and far. In the middle of the night, I needed some air, and I needed to piss, and we had no bucket. So I snuck out, a scrap of shadow, and squatted over a lucky clump of weeds near the ancient stones, a painful stance with all my bruising. Way back in the direction of the balcony cliffs, I could see cracklings of flame licking out over the tops of rocks and trees, and to the northeast and the west, other fires had broken out, as if the action taken against us had been part of something larger. Much of the center of the city from that vantage seemed in dispute, but who fought, whose fortunes rose and fell, and in what neighborhoods lay hidden from me? I was finishing up when I noticed the perfect stillness of the night, which I had put down to my impaired hearing, but might mean something more. I stood, quickly buttoned my pants, climbed up the cistern stones as best as I was able, and searched for hints of movement out in the night. It was all twisted bands of black, the branches of the dead deformed forest at a slant down to the dead plain that preceded the company building. Between the trees, for a long distance, patches of lighter shadow shone in the dim light, the clouds above almost blue-violet. Nothing appeared, nothing moved, but I was patient, let my gaze drift. From the top of the cistern, so much territory spread out below that anything moving there would be in sight for quite some time. Then, down through the forest, to where it leveled out before one last gentle slope, a rippling of invisible turbulence, a kind of rising through the air as of steam that manifested across those lighter patches. I could not be sure,
but my instincts told me someone was running at great speed down the slope and had been visible from that angle for some time, even if I couldn't see them. And you only ran like that if you were being pursued. So I followed a line back from the flustered air, and maybe 200 feet back up the slope, I found a coarse, moving river. Too familiar. Too much like fur. A silent bounding and a wraith-like darkness, a surging, churning bloodlust, all bare in its reckless but joyful trajectory. At least 3 proxies. In pursuit of what? Their prey had lost a step on them, I saw, had stopped as if to think, that whirlpool of shadow, and then a swift turn on the heel toward new coordinates farther south. The shimmer against the trees reminded me of someone. Then it was all just silence and movements I could not make sense of, and I went back inside. To my surprise, Wick waited for me, standing as if he had never been asleep. The light from the well water washed over him in shades of electric blue. "Moored proxies," I said. Wick nodded. I didn't tell him I thought the magician might be out there, headed south like us. Even free of the balcony cliffs, I felt if he knew, he might be influenced in a way bad for both of us. As we packed, Wick said,
"You need to figure out what you want to be after, other than a scavenger."
"After what?" I asked, but he never told me.